So there was a little bit of concern. The nation Klai Yisrael saw that Moshe was hesitating to come down from the mountain. So they all gathered up together to Aaron HaKohen. And they said to him, make for us a new God. Strange request. Because Moshe, he took us out of Egypt, and now he went up, and it's been so long, but we don't know what happened to him. So Aaron responds to them in the exact opposite of what you would have expected. He's enthusiastic about it. He says, take off all your gold, all your jewelry, all your diamonds, that in the ears of your wives, your kids, your daughters, and bring it to me. Aaron's, he's egging them on. He wants this to move faster. And 1, 2, 3, chick-chack, they did it. And they all brought it to him. So he throws all this gold into the oven, and we all know how the story starts, how the story ends. And next thing you know, before you have it, an egel in front of Klal Yisrael. Vayar Aaron, and again, unexpected. You want Aaron to destroy it, to tell everybody that it's not real, it's false. Vayiven mizbeach lefana. But he builds an altar in front of it. Vayikra Aaron, Vayomar, Chag LaHashem Machar. Tomorrow we're going to celebrate. We're going to dance. Tomorrow we're going to have a fun time. Vayashkimu Mimacharas, and they all woke up the next morning. Vayalu Olos Vyagishu Shlomim, they gave all their sacrifices, all their korbanos. Vayeshev Ha'om Lecho Vishasu Vayakumu Litzachik. They all got up and they had a festive meal, a nice big seuda. They ate and they drank, and vayakumu litzachik, they were quite merry. Says Rashi, avodah zarah and gilui arayos and shfichas damim. All the fun that somebody could have dreamed of. And then the episode continues. Vayihi kasher korov el hamachane. Now from a different perspective, Moshe's walking slowly down the mountain and he starts to get close to the camp. Vayar es ha'egel, and he sees in the middle of the circles an egel, a golden calf. Umacholos, and they're dancing the hora with the havanagila around the egel. Vayichar af Moshe, and he gets angry. He burns up inside. Not like Aaron reacted. And he takes the two luchos. Vayashlech miyada v'saluchos ha'yishaber osam tachas ahar. And then he gets down there finally. Vayikach es ha'egel. He grabs onto the calf. Vayitzrof ba'esh. He burns it in fire. Vayitchon ad asher dak. And then he crushes it until it's fine and ground. Vayizer al pnei amayim. Vayash es pnei Yisrael. He treated them like a sota. He dipped a little bit of the ashes from the egel, a little bit of the crushed up gold, into cups of water. And each member of Klal Yisrael drank a little bit from the cup. And if he did avodah zarah, if he served the egel, so exactly what happened to a sota. His stomach crumbled. And he blew up. So too to Klal Yisrael. Vayomer Moshe Aaron, and now he's complaining. The Aaron, my brother. Ma asalacha ha'am. What did they do to you? Ki yivis olocha togedolo, that you did this to them. What did they do so bad to you that they deserve this? Vayomer Aaron, al yichar af, don't be angry at me. Atu yodati, you know that this am ki berahu, you know this is a terrible nation. They came to me and they asked me to make a new God. And what did I know? I couldn't think of anything. I tried to stall. So I gathered up all the gold and I threw it into the oven. Did I expect that an eagle should come out? And he said, he announced to everybody, Mi la Hashem elai. Whoever is from God's camp, come to me now. Vayasfu alav kol b'nei Levi. And Levi came forward. Vayomer lohem, simu ish harbo ayirecho, take out your swords. Ivru v'shuvu mishar l'shar, go from gate to gate to gate of all Klal Yisrael. V'hergu ish es ochiv, v'ish es re'ehu, v'ish es krovo. And kill your brother, and kill your cousin, and kill your friend. Vayasu bnei Levi kedvar Moshe. Vayipol minaom bayom ahu kishloshes alfei ish. And 3,000 of their brethren, they killed with their own swords. The whole thing is strange. From start to finish. Aaron's enthusiastic about creating a new God that they can serve. Right after, a few short days after Matan Torah, that they're all celebrating, they saw God with their own eyes. All 7 rakiyas opened up and they could see exactly what's upstairs. They didn't need all the proofs we have on Emunah Day. They saw with their eyes that there is a God. They saw with their eyes at Sinai. They saw with their eyes Matan Torah. And just a few short days later, so fast, the speed of it all troubles me. And so there's a Ramban. Everybody should know this Ramban. If I'm repeating it, I apologize. Says the Ramban, we're making a big mistake. Ki biyodua, it's well known. Shelo hayu Yisrael svurim shemoshe hu ha'elokim. Nobody thought that Moshe was God. Nobody thought that Moshe himself is the one who did all the miracles. That Moshe himself is the one who took them out of Mitzrayim. And how does it make sense that they complained to Aaron? Since Moshe is not coming down, we need a new God. The complaint doesn't make sense, doesn't fit with the solution. If Moshe is gone, so why do you need a new God? God is not gone. Their request was not for a God. Elokim means master. They were asking for a new master. A substitute for Moshe Rabbeinu. Amru Moshe shehoru lanu haderach mimitzrayim biadhena, Moshe who led us on the path until now. Hine avod mimenu, he is lost from us. Nase lanu Moshe acher. Let's create a new Moshe. V'chein hoya hadover. Ki kevon shiro ho'am es Moshe. When they saw Moshe come down from the mountain, miyad hinichu es ha'egel. They all backed off. The party ended. The horror stopped. Everybody sat down. And Moshe was free. Sheinichu lo l'sarfo. Moshe was free to go and gather up the egel and burn it. Ulizaru safaru, and to crush it into ashes. Velo hoya mehem cholak olav klal. And nobody argued with Moshe. So it was an intermediary. Nobody was looking for a new God. Klal Yisrael was just looking for a means to connect to God. Moshe's gone. We need a new substitute. So you look back and you wonder, so what's the big deal now? Mi la shem ilai. Go kill your brothers, your aunts, your uncles. Go kill the rest of the Shvatim. 3,000 people died on that day. And then the Magifa, so many more people died. And then the people who were judged with the water, with the Sota. Thousands and thousands of Jews are dying. For what? That they asked for a new Moshe? That's so bad. And then there's 2 things that were a tshuva for Chet HaEgel. Yisrael nosnu zov la'egel at she'amar lehem dai. Yisrael gave over their gold for the egel until they said, die. Die, it's enough. We got everything we need. V'notvu zov le'mishkan at she'amar lehem dai. And so too, they donated gold to the Mishkan until Moshe said, die. Enough. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So God said, yavo zov ha'mishkan v'yechaper al zov ha'egel. The gold of the Mishkan, the donations of the Mishkan, should be mechaper for Chet HaEgel. Seemingly nothing to do with each other. Very nice, the Mishkan is a wonderful mitzvah. A wonderful mitzvah that creates Hashra'as HaShchina. Nothing to do with Chet HaEgel. No reason that this should be mechaper on that. And then it gets even stranger. All the karbonos are male. Vizu, para aduma, is female, is in the keva. Omer of Ivo. Moshe leben shivcha shetinev paltin shamelech. It's like the daughter, the son, the child of a maidservant who made the palace dirty. Omer hamelech. So the king yelled out, Tavo imo, let this child's mother come, v'tekaneach es hatzoa, and clean up the mess that this child made. Kach amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so too God said, Tavo para, this para aduma should come, v'techaper el maisa ha'egel. Now that's very cute. That's a cow, and that's a cow, and the baby cow made the palace dirty. It was a terrible avera, and the mother cow has to clean up for the terrible avera. Para aduma is a chok. Para aduma has no rhyme or reason. Nobody has discovered it. Nobody will discover it. And the Medrash claims we know the reason. The reason for para aduma is to be machaper on chet ha'egel. You deny the existence of the chok. And why one cow could be machaper on another cow? Entirely nonsensical. In the 16th century, there was a revolution of cosmic proportions. Literally. It was best said, best described by a fellow by the name of Martin Luther. There is talk of a new astrologer, he said, in 1539. Who wants to prove that the earth moves and goes around instead of the sun. Just as if, he gives a mashal to show how ridiculous this idea is. Just as if somebody were moving in a carriage or a ship might think that he was sitting still, completely at rest, while the trees were moving around him and the ocean was what is moving. But that is how things are nowadays. When a man wishes to be clever, he must invent something special. And the way he does it must be the best. And he said about those scientists at that time, these fools want to turn the whole art of astronomy upside down. And this idea, it's called heliocentrism. That the whole universe revolves around the sun. It was not a new idea. Scientists proposed this BC, AD. It's been around for a long time. But it started to get more controversial and more political when a fellow by the name of Galileo started to prove its authenticity. But people refused to believe it. This was ludicrous. I'm standing right here. We're not moving. Nothing's moving here. Open your eyes, Galileo. You can clearly see the sun was there in the morning. It's there at night. No better proof than that. And so they thought the whole thing was absurd. And as they did in those crazy medieval times, they brought him to trial. They brought Galileo for the crime of denying and rejecting the beliefs of the Catholic Church. And they didn't treat this lightly. No, it was a big deal. Geocentric thought always taught that the whole universe revolves around the earth. And here comes Galileo and his friends to say otherwise. So after many threats on him and many bans on all of his books, they finally placed on him the highest punishment. They sentenced him to house arrest in his country home in Florence, away from all his students, not to have a connection to his Talmidim. Additionally, they ordered that on a weekly basis, he has to read the 7 penitential psalms. So an hour in the Tiv Aryeh terms. He was sent to Galus, and he was forced to go to davening. But people fear any kinds of reform. You'd rather stick with your guns, believe that the whole universe revolves around the earth. You don't want to look in the telescope. You don't want to look up in the sky. You don't want to know something different than what you've always believed. I'd rather hold on to everything that I had. And it's the famous story of Lieutenant Hiro Onada. In 1942, Mr. Onada was a 20-year-old, innocent Japanese citizen. And he was called up to the army. So they saw that he had raw talent. There was something special about this boy. So they brought him in. They sent him to the Imperial Army Intelligence School. So after basic training, he went on. He gained expertise in gathering information about the enemy, intelligence. And he became one of the Army's best at guerrilla warfare. Before leaving to Japan to fight in the Philippines, he was ordered by his commander, "You are absolutely forbidden to die by your own hand." I would do this in a Japanese accent, but my British is much better. "It may take 3 years," said his commander. "It may take five. But whatever happens, we'll come back for you. Until then, as long as you have one soldier, you are to continue to lead him. You may have to live on coconuts. If you find that you have to live on coconuts, then live on coconuts. Under no circumstances are you to give up your life voluntarily." And with that order from his commander, he was sent to the Philippines. Now, Mr. Onada took this order much more seriously than his commander ever expected. Soon after his arrival in the Philippines, the Allies overtook the island. It wasn't long, a few months, until the atomic bomb was dropped and Japan surrendered. In October 1945 is when he got the first leaflet. He was walking in the jungle and he picked up, there were papers dropped. And he picked them up and they all said the same thing. "Attention, on August 15th, we, Japan, surrendered. The war is over. Come down from the mountains." Now, Onada had patriotism. He was here to fight for Mother Japan. So he looked at this leaflet. He examined this leaflet. And then he concluded, based on his intelligence, based on all his training, it must be a clever ruse by the Allied propagandists. And again, the outside world tried to continue to contact Lieutenant Onada. They dropped leaflets out of a Boeing B-17 near the end of 1945. Printed on these leaflets were the handwritten surrender from General Yamashita of the 14th Area Army. Now, having already hidden on the island for over a year, Lieutenant Onada took this letter like a Gemara. Every word, he was medayik. Why said it like that? Why did he surrender in these words? Why did he use that phrase? Why did he use that term? And again, after analyzing this new leaflet, he concluded with absolute positivity it was a ploy. It was again a hoax from the Allies. Leaflet after leaflet was dropped. Newspapers were left over. Pictures from family. Letters begging him to come out. Friends and relatives spoke over loudspeakers in the Philippines. But there was always something suspicious. So he never believed that the war was really over. Over the next 30 years, Lieutenant Onada was in the jungles of the Philippines, eating coconuts, gathering intelligence, setting barns on fire, attacking local villagers, performing the guerrilla warfare that he knew best. Until 1974, a college dropout, Norio Suzuki, decided to travel over Asia. He went to the Philippines, Singapore, Malaysia, Nepal, and he had three goals on this trip. This is wonderful. Three goals on this trip. Number one, to find a panda bear. They have him at zoos. Number two, to make direct contact with the abominable snowman. And number three, to track down Lieutenant Onada. Now, I don't know how he fared with the panda bear. And I'm guessing he never found contact with the abominable snowman. But one morning, deep in the jungle of the Philippines, he found Lieutenant Onada in 1974. And he said to him, "It's over. Give it up. What are you doing?" And Lieutenant Onada stood firm. "I will not surrender. They told me they'll come back. I refuse to give up for Mother Japan. We die to the last soldier. Until you bring my commander here to the Philippine jungle and tells me with his mouth and I see him face to face that it's over, I will continue to fight." These innocent farmers in the Philippines are being attacked day after day. Lieutenant Onada is determined to continue. Now, what could possibly be the relevance of this story? Besides for learning the lesson, stop attacking the villagers when everybody's telling you the war is over. But there's much more. It's a mentality. Supreme obedience. Following orders at all costs. The utter refusal to reform. And we have to put this in perspective. It seems the most logical approach is to embrace reform, to accept newfound discoveries, to endorse new inventions, on an overall level to infuse our lives with all the changes and advances of our time. But really, it depends. It depends on the cause. It depends on the need. Like the Kutzker said, when they invented the train, they all rushed to his house. "You won't believe it. Faster than a horse. The engine's moving. The smoke is coming out. They could put person after person. They could put cattle. They could deliver objects and items. And it's train car after train car on these tracks. And they go so fast and so far and so wide." And they were telling him, "This is so exciting. The train, the train, the train." And the cuts go with one line. "Where does everybody need to go so badly? What's everybody getting so excited about?" Because there's two ways to reform. On the most basic level, to detract or to add. When I was in seventh grade, I was determined to make the basketball team. Now, I made first cut, right? Like everybody made first cut, right? Yeah, right. Neither did I. I was skinny. I was short. I couldn't post up. Couldn't box out. Didn't have three-point range. But I was determined. And the coach told me, "You work hard. You put in the time. You put in the effort. If you're not going to make it in seventh grade, you could hope for eighth." And I did. Day in and day out, working on my three-point shot, working on my layup. I was working on my game. Wasn't going anywhere. I wasn't accomplishing anything. But I was determined. So I decided, after trying long and hard, if I wasn't going to be the king of Yeshiva League, I was at least going to be the king in my own backyard. So I had this epiphany, this wonderful epiphany that made my childhood. I invited my friends to come over. And we're playing in my backyard. So I make the rules. I took a 10-foot jumper. Nailed it. I said, "Three." I was a three. Write it up. Three, guys. And you're right. "What are you talking about?" I said, no. "My foot was behind the line. The line's right there. It's my backyard. I make the rules." And I told my dad, "The rim, foot and a half, two and a half feet, lower a little bit." Nailing layups. I was almost dunking. I was the champ. Nobody could stop me. And this is how I decided to change the whole game to fit me. And this is how I became, arguably, the world's greatest athlete. You see, I bowl consistently 250 or above because I got the bumpers on the sides. And I average every hockey game at least a hat trick Because I add a foot on each side of the goal. And my golf game, 2 under par. Because I have a 35 handicap. You see, when you want to excel, it's much easier to change the game than to change yourself. And I love when adults beam with pride about their little children. Oh my God, do you see? So precious. Our 2-year-old's a genius. He knows how to use an iPhone. Isn't it amazing? And I think this 2-year-old looks up at his dad and thinks to himself, oh my God, my dad's a grown man and all he knows how to do is play with his iPhone. We change the rules. Instead of deciding what makes us intellectuals and intelligent, we'll make it up. And if a 2-year-old could do it, so he's also a genius. Look at that. But I'm not lower than him. He might be as good as me. So it's common for man to detract from his responsibilities, from his religion, and from his standards. Because the smaller the mountain, the easier it is to get to the top. But there's a whole other reform that's just as dangerous. See, there's a practice of a lot of seminaries here in Israel that on Thursday afternoon is Chesed Day, similar to us. Now, what that means practically for me is that every Thursday afternoon, a seminary girl comes to my house, takes my kids to the park for a few hours so my wife could cook for Shabbos. It's a wonderful deal. But occasionally, though, you get the industrious type. They tell my wife, you take the kids to the park. I'm going to cook. Now, this is dangerous. Depends on the wife. See, my wife is very into her recipes, her dishes. So to let this new girl cook, there's a little bit of a hesitation. But mostly they're compliant. Except one Erev Shavuos a few years back. I got home late, and my wife is frantic. 11, 12 at night, just starting to get cooking. And I'm wondering, it's Thursday. The seminary girl came today. Didn't she take the kids to the park? Didn't you cook this afternoon? What's going on? What happened? My wife looks at me. The married people know this look. She wanted to cook. And it's happened before. I was so clear. I gave her a clear recipe with clear instructions, this much flour, this much cheese, this much sugar, and 1 scoop of chocolate ice cream. How hard is that? Why couldn't she? What happened? What went wrong? And she says, I don't know. I got home and I opened the oven and there's pan after pan after pan overflowing with melted ice cream. Melted ice cream. All over chocolate, and then a little in each pan, a little bit of cheesecake. What did she do? And my wife says, classic seminary. I gave her the recipe, and I get home, and I said to her what happened. And she says, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You don't understand. I was doing everything you told me. I put the sugar, I put the flour, I put the cheese, and then the 1 scoop of chocolate ice cream. I love chocolate ice cream. I couldn't control myself. I put scoop after scoop after scoop. Isn't it so delicious? Now, I can understand that a seminary girl might like chocolate ice cream. I can. But sometimes if you want the cheesecake to come out good, you got to follow the recipe. And nobody really knows what the Vilna Gaon was so angry about with Hasidus. But one theory that became very popular is they were adding. They were changing the recipe that was always perfect. And that, he disagreed. You see, in the Mishkan, after every brick was put into the Mishkan, the brick was put in, says the Pasuk, Kasher Tzivo Hashem. The Ohel was made, end of the Pasuk, Kasher Tzivo Hashem. They made the Aron, end of the Pasuk, Kasher Tziva Hashem. And Pasuk after Pasuk after Pasuk, you'll see next week and the following, every single Pasuk will end off, Kasher, Kasher, Kasher Tziva Hashem. Exactly the way God intended. Every single Pasuk. And Parah Aduma has no rhyme or reason. Parah Aduma, we do it because Tziva Hashem. And that was the opposite of Chayta Egel. See, what Chayta Egel was a third opinion. See, it wasn't geocentric, where the whole universe revolves around the earth. It wasn't heliocentric, where the whole universe revolves around the sun. No, it was a new concept. It was called egocentric. The whole world revolves around this. The whole world revolves around me. And I get to decide how much chocolate ice cream goes in the cheesecake. And I get to decide who my intermediary is between God. And I get to decide what my religious practices are, what I add, what I detract, how much percentage of the time I do it, and how much percentage I don't. Because if I'm doing it 75% of the time, and I'm 84% accurate, well, isn't that not bad? Isn't that passing too? And when it comes to religion, what can it do for me? What can Judaism do for me? What can Torah, why do I need Torah? What can God provide me? And we're living in this world where God and Torah and Judaism and everything, your families and your friends, and don't lie to yourself, revolve around this existence that is me. This egocentric mentality that nobody could have thought of back in the 1500s, but today it's the most pervasive thing in society. And we can make a Super Bowl commercial out of it. Because we treat God and religion like a can of Pepsi, a Budweiser, or a bag of Doritos. Is it going to satisfy me? Like I'm really hungry for spirituality. Is that really going to fulfill me? Is that going to satiate my desires? Is it going to make me happy? Because that's what I'm looking for. Whatever it's going to be, I'm not really altruistic and looking for the right thing. I'm just looking for the thing that will give me more. More satisfaction, more fulfillment, more... Now this is beautiful. These are beautiful byproducts of God and Torah and religion. But that's not how it starts. And then we think further. What can I do to improve the product? Because of course, God's product will never be perfect. Maybe I could make Minyan shorter. Maybe I could make Minyan optional. I'll make Night Seder different. I'll change up the whole thing according to my plan, the way it's going to satisfy me best. And you make your goals more accessible. You shrink your mountains. You bring in the three-point line. You lower the rim. You know, I'll make a Siyum HaShas, but why do I got to do it the old way? I'll do it the art scroll. I'll listen to Shiurim. I'll finish Shas 6 times and still not be able to read 1 line on my own. I could pull that off. And better yet, rationalize to yourself that this beautiful Shas, that inside of this beautiful, wonderful Shas contains the beauty and wisdom that has existed in Klal Yisrael for thousands of years, and you rationalize. That's not really important. That's not really for me. That's not really what Judaism is. You know these English books that I like by my Malcolm? That's where it really is. Those are quick. I like that. You know, reading a little bit with my Harus in the English. He reads the English. But the Gemara, that's a little... That's, it doesn't satisfy me. It doesn't make me happy. It only makes me more stressed out. And we know, after all, religion is about right here. So if everything's about right here and it's not doing it, so it's not true. Must be a hoax. Leaflets dropped from the sky. And you don't believe it. Because you keep your own orders. The only commander that we choose to listen to. And nobody should be mistaken. Because I know some guys, when I'm talking about reforming Judaism, the first thing that pops into your head is girls wearing tefillin. And I'm so disinterested in girls wearing tefillin because who cares? Who honestly cares? They've tried and they've tried and they've tried again to reform our religion. And they won't stop trying. Nothing will stop. What I'm really concerned about is the way we are reforming our religion. Because there's a phrase we all know. if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But we don't believe that. We think it is broke. It's routine. It's boring. It's very difficult. It's completely broken. And I remember I heard an athlete retire for those reasons. He said it was boring. He said it was routine. He lost interest. He was a third string quarterback. He never played. He sat on the sidelines while everybody else was involved, building themselves, building their strengths, building the team. He was a third string quarterback. So yeah, of course. If you're not climbing the mountain, you're not going to get to the top. You want to make it shrink so small that it's level, so you'll be on the top. And you could praise yourself. But how far did you actually go? The real thing sometimes we need to reform is right here. So stop convincing ourselves. We should all stop convincing ourselves that the Egels of today, that my iPhone, you don't understand. My iPhone is actually the way I learn. I got all the apps that allow me to learn on the highest madriga. And I wonder, isn't Rav Nevinson missing out? I find this so sad. He never had this. Apparently he can't reach any significant level because he's lacking these apps. The old way doesn't work. It's apparently broken. So we need to come up with newfound ways to fix it. At my secular colleges that I plan on going to, those, you see, because you don't know me, I work against the tide. That's how I work. Like if everybody's religious, so I don't do it. But if I go to secular college and everybody's not religious, boom, the next Rav Nevinson right here. You're looking at him. And my girlfriend, no, you have no, are you joking me? She brings me the closest to God. She pushes me. She supports me. She encourages me. Without her, I would be nowhere today. And all these apparatuses that never existed before, we're reforming the whole world because religion's right here. I sit back in the limo and you know God's driving because that's what I told him to do. He follows my lead. I say drive, he drives. I say stop, he stops. Once in a while, I'll pull down that window, drop in a little tip to recognize, hey, yeah, I remember you, you remember me, but I'm in control. I call the shots. And you're revolving around my universe. Because this is where it is. And I can't help but cry is the only word I could think of. There's a way this is supposed to be done. There is a way this has always been done. There is a way people were actually able to succeed. And it has nothing to do with selling yourself short. And why is everybody always so content with selling yourself short? Because in seventh grade, I also felt that way. That if I can't hit a three, so then this is a three-pointer. But don't we grow up? Don't we realize that forget to change the game, maybe it's about time to change you, to change me, to change us? Not to reform the system, not to reform the game, but to reform right here. Because things, if you do it right, if you do it the way it's supposed to be done, and excuse my language, if you do it kasher tzivo Hashem, then you succeed. Then you have the whole picture. You know, this religion is not in a small vacuum that we just showed up and we could decide things are not exactly the way they should be. Things are not exactly the way that I perceive they could be. And I always think, a very simple mashal, that a guy walks into a shul and he sees the gabbai giving out aliyahs. And the gabbai gives aliyahs to the strangest group of people. One nobody in the back, one random schlepper on the right side, another guy and shlishi and maftir, and the newcomer looks around and he says, this gabbai doesn't know how to do the job. If I was the gabbai here, that's the wealthy guy over there, that's the president of the shul, that guy's a very important guy. These are how you give aliyahs. Doesn't know how to distribute it. So he goes up to the gabbai at the end of shul, and he says, listen, sit down, I'll teach you. Apparently you don't know what you're doing. I'll teach you, I'll do you a favor, a chesed. And the Gavai says, excuse me, how long are you here? You're here for a couple hours? You already decided how everything's supposed to work? You weren't here last week. You weren't here 2 weeks ago. You know who got aliyahs for the last month, for the last year? You know how the system works? You showed up, you're here for a couple hours. You're a guest. You're a visitor. And already you want to change the whole world? Maybe you could trust me that I have a plan too? Kach amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so too said God. You showed up for a few minutes. You want to reform the whole system. Like it just started. Make an egel. Have whoever you want put on tefillin. Cut things short. Cut things out. Pick and choose. 72%, 64% of the time. You're just a visitor. You just showed up. I have a plan too. Hashem should give us siyata d'shmaya that we should come to this recognition in machshava, in maisa, in our thought, in our deeds, to do and to believe what's right, to live life like Rav Podolsky used to end the shmooze, to live life as it should be lived, kasher tziva Hashem. Shabbos. Shabbos.